Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Mick Garrison. This is Postmortem AMA, where you get to ask me anything. And the way you do it is through producer Joe Russo, who has your questions for me today. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm good, Mick. I mean, it's been a weird week in America.
Oh, no kidding. It's been a weird 4 years in America.
Yeah, but I think it was this was the cherry on top. So, but it's a perfect segue, actually, to our first question.
Awesome.
Nick Roberts asks, during tumultuous times, do you prefer escapism or social commentary when choosing films to watch?
Well, they're not mutually exclusive. You know, I think stuff like His House does both. It is, it's great entertainment and it's also heavy social comment. I don't make a choice, but it does feel like sometimes things are just a little too light for me to appreciate when we're in the middle of stuff like this. I do like the escapism of a good comedy or a good horror movie or a good thriller or something like that. But I also, I feel connected to the world in a very deep way. And when something as overwhelming as is what's going on right now in our world, I don't really want to turn my attention away from it for too long.
Yeah, no, I after the attack on the Capitol last week, I went for a comedy just because I just couldn't, there was just so much, we watched so much news that day.
Yeah. Oh, I'll do that too. There's no question I will, but I do watch CNN and MSNBC and the local news quite a bit more than usual.
Yeah, especially right now. Did you get any writing done? That's an interesting question.
Not since the explosion of the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really hard. And I think sometimes it's okay to give yourself that reprieve and just kind of let yourself absorb it emotionally, you know?
Yeah. And I hike several miles every day. So that is my escape too. I try not to put the news channels in my ear pods. I'll usually listen to an audio book or something.
Smart.
We all need relief occasionally, and I don't want to become one of those people who's always angry about what's going on in the world and try and keep it in context. But this is important stuff, maybe the most important stuff that's happened since 9/11.
I agree. It reminded me a lot of that day. Obviously, the death toll was significantly lower, but the scope and the importance of it.
But between this and the coronavirus and all, but this is a horror movie.
Yeah, let's get off of politics. Yeah. So, actually, before we get into horror, though, this is an interesting question, you know, and we get a lot of questions about filmmaking, and we do have some of those today, too. But I thought this was a little different. Patrick R. McDonough asks, do you have any advice for new podcasters?
Well, that is different. It's we've been doing this. This is our fifth season now. And the main advice is don't look to it as a career.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Percentage wise, there are not a whole lot of people. But, you know, it's basically what I can only speak for myself is I'm having conversations with people who fascinate me. It's an interview podcast rather than a discussion of favorite movies, or, you know, counting down my 10 favorite films or books or comics or whatever. It's really a conversation with people who inspire me, which is why I got into journalism back in my college days, back in my teenage days, even before that in high school. The first interview I ever did was with Ray Bradbury, and then I did Rod Serling, and when I was, you know, barely in my teens, you know. So it's got to be something you love. It's something you have passion for that you want to keep doing. And that may be your top 10 horror movies this week, or what's going on. But a passion to me is everything, and not expecting to make a living off of it is an important part of that. You do it out of love and passion, and hopefully you will find an audience that, and if there's a unique way to do it. There are so many different podcasts, so many similar themes and the like, but find a way to make it your own. In this case, I'm lucky enough to be a filmmaker who's talking with filmmakers, an author who talks with authors, and people working within the industry that I am a part of. So it makes it a little bit different when you're interviewing filmmakers, and that's your job too. So if you can find a window that makes your experience unique, I think that's the way to go. If not for success, at least for happiness.
Passion is contagious, and I think that's why people respond to your interviews, because they can tell you have a passion for the subject matter and the subject. And I think that's why, you know, we've been so lucky to have had our show grow so much over the last few years.
Yeah, it's pretty great, and it's really fun. At first, it was just kind of, oh, this would be a nice hobby, when you introduced me to the people at Podcast One with their interest in doing it. I never thought of doing a podcast until that came up when you talked to them about that. And now here we are in season 5.
Yeah, four years later. Unbelievable. Yeah.
almost 100 interviews that we've done so far with a lot of my idols, people who were friends, people I didn't know, but whose work I knew and appreciated. And now it's quite a library we've put together and continue to do so.
Yeah, we're very proud of it. Well, switching gears back to horror, Haley Daggett asks, how can a young person break into the horror genre right now?
Well, I think it's easier and harder than ever. Yep. Yeah, you can make your own movies and post them wherever you can. Getting a job, making money off of that is a very difficult thing. The independent film world, there's so much product out there. It's very difficult to find what's worthwhile and what's not. For me, and this is a long time ago, before there was streaming and before there were YouTube sites and the internet at all, when I began back in the 80s, I was a writer. And the easiest way you can present your stories and ideas and abilities is in script form. It doesn't cost you anything to write. And then if you are able to find people who find value in the work that you do in that regard, it's easier to do it from a writing point of view. However, these days you have tools that I didn't have when I was a budding young filmmaker, like an iPhone and a laptop and an iPad, where you can make really high quality films for virtually no budget. The secret is collaborating with very talented people, not necessarily your best friends, who may not be the best actors or the best cinematographers or makeup artists or whatever. And, you know, for me, I would just recommend writing and see if you can get it to people who make a difference. And usually you have to do that through agents, so that the agents would be the first step. So, Joe, you've come into this field much more recently than I have. So what's your point of view?
I mean, you know, it's funny. Even though we're talking about, you know, years apart, the process remains pretty much the same, even with more advances in technology. I mean, it's just about creating really great high-end content, whether that be short films or whether that be screenplays. You know, I think the cream has a way to rising to the top, and you know, if you do genuinely create something that is good, people will find it. And that energy is contagious and people want to share it. And that's how you get noticed.
And I don't think it's necessarily high concept. I think it can be very small in idea, but really good, you know, and unique and iconoclastic in a way. But do something that stands out from everything else, because everyone is exposed to everything. Agents read 30 scripts. They take them home every weekend. And if you don't hook them by page one often, they may just toss it on the stack. And grammar matters, but mostly it is getting them to keep wanting to turn the next page if you do it through screenwriting. You can make beautiful, professional, polished films on your own, but it's the content that is everything.
And now, right now, in this moment, there are really great websites and YouTube channels and such that congregate great horror shorts like Gunpowder and Sky's Altar and Eli Roth's Crypt TV, where they're either making shorts or they're acquiring them from independent filmmakers. And those can be great platforms to get your movie seen by hundreds of thousands of people on the internet.
Yeah. Yep. And that's something we didn't have when I was trying to make my go in the world of writing and directing movies.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, I did one for each of the in Fun Size Horror too, Molly Elfman's Fun Size Horror. You know, I did one for each of those, and then I directed the feature recently. So I think there is some progression to that. And it's interesting. Our next question actually kind of bleeds into this a little bit. Imero SJ asks, are screenplay competitions a smart investment for unknown screenwriters? I don't know if screenplay competitions were a thing back when you were starting to write, Mick.
No, they weren't. And so I've never entered a screenplay competition. But it depends. Some of them are commercial ventures. Mm-hmm. And it's just a way to make money off of hopeful writers.
Yep.
But some of them really are connected to judges who are worthwhile. That these are things, you know, the Blacklist is not a competition that you can enter on your own.
Right.
But they do land on the desks of important agents who represent these. The agents do look into some of the better competitions. So it depends. The commercial endeavors, I think, are just greedy creeps.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful. There's a lot of people who say that they are, a lot of like small little film festivals have a screenplay competition element, and it essentially is just a money generating thing for the film festival. You have to be very careful about who you enter into it. Ironically, earlier this week, my writing group put together a list of contests that actually are pretty well known and reputable. So I figured I'd just throw out a couple of the names. Just to give our listeners some direction. Austin Film Festival is probably the biggest and most preeminent because it's a very writer-driven film festival.
Great festival.
Have you ever been, Mick?
I have. I've participated, and been on panels and things there.
And their screenplay competition is extremely reputable. They get great people like Mick out to the festival to interact with the people who go.
Graduate into successful writing careers from that competition.
They really do. They really do. So that's probably one of the, and then the Nichols Fellowship, it's sponsored by the Academy. It's a really big one. It's that one tends to, I mean, I know I've known lots of writers who have made even the quarter and semifinals of that and found representation off of it because it's just such a prestigious list. But for genre writers, it's a little tougher because it is sponsored by the Academy. So the list does kind of turn its nose up a little bit to,
well, there are things like Scream Fest and, you know, that's here in LA. So they do have access to some people who can make a difference.
Right. But there are a couple other competitions like Final Draft, Big Break, and Screencraft, and Tracking Dashboard and Tracking B, those tend to let genre content kind of bubble to the top, as long as the writing's great. So those are a couple places that people can look. But outside of that grouping, I would be very leery about film festival competitions. But if you can place in one of those kind of well-known competitions, it does what you said in the last question, which is it allows your piece of material to get in front of the right people. And hopefully that opens the doors to a career.
Yeah, that's the important thing.
Absolutely. All right. Greg Green wants to know if you think there's a horror subgenre that is deserving of more cinematic attention.
Well, I think anything that that does something new, you know, body horror is always going to be alive and well or unwell. you know, ghost stories, there's still ways to tell ghost stories in a new original way. You know, werewolf movies, well, let's see if we can ever have an original werewolf movie again. It's been a while.
I have faith in Lee Whannell to come up with something interesting.
Here's hoping. you know, zombie movies, I thought that there's no way that there could ever be another original one. And even though it's a couple of years old now, One Cut of the Dead is like one of the most phenomenally creative uses of a subgenre ever. But is there a neglected subgenre? Well, I wouldn't know, because if it's been neglected, I'm not aware of it. But I think the ghost story is something that always gives new life, ironically, because it's about the dead. But, you know, there are always new ways to tell a ghost story. And I do it myself in books and in films relatively often. And I think it's a football that you can keep tossing without losing air.
I think also, too, horror specifically tends to move in waves. I mean, subgenres tend to, one will work really well, we'll get a boom in that subgenre, and then it'll get saturated and fade away. And it's very cyclical, I think.
Yeah, it'll play itself out.
Yeah, but I think if you're trying to game the market and say, oh, I'm going to do this one, I don't think that's really how it works. I think you just have to write what you're most passionate about, direct what you're most passionate about.
Absolutely. I think that's the most important thing, because, you know, you can't guide the tastes of the cinema going audience. Mm-hmm. And all you can do is do the best work you can. And again, I'll say that the most original work that you can do is what's going to stand out and would have a chance of attention, if not outright success.
I agree. So the next question is actually one that came in for me. So I will briefly answer it. Michael Cassie wants to know, what's next for Joe? Do you see yourself continuing to direct or focusing more on writing, producing? So I think with the pandemic, it kind of prevented a lot of people from directing for a while. So yes, my goal is to still keep directing, but you know, my hope is by the time I do it again, this pandemic will be behind us and we can, you know, go back to work safely. There's a couple things in the fire for me to direct. But you know, they're long-term plays and we're looking kind of past the pandemic. I've been very focused on writing in between, just mostly because I've had some great opportunities present themselves over the last, even before the pandemic. So, you know, that's kind of gotten me through creatively and financially. And I'm not gonna, you know, derail that momentum just to go direct again, but, I'm sure it will happen when it's supposed to happen.
The doors of opportunity open and you walk through them, whether they're anticipated or not.
Exactly. Exactly. Adam analyzes, wonders if you were offered the chance, would you ever consider returning to the Critters franchise?
No.
Why is that?
Been there, done that. You know, I think we did a really great Critters movie. And I don't know how much play there is left in giant toothed dust mops with fangs that roll into a ball. You know, I love the Critters movie that we did. But I just don't feel that I need to go back to that playground.
And honestly, I mean, you, in my opinion, you did the best in the series. So, well, you know, why go back and risk that legacy, you know?
That's right. Don't want to mess that up. Yeah.
No. Matthew sometimes asks, and this is somewhat related, but I thought you would get a kick out of it, if you would ever consider remaking Fuzzbucket.
No. That is something that could be improved upon. But, you know, I wouldn't mind, and we have a conversation planned about with Disney Plus about various projects, but I do intend to bring up the idea of an animated series based on Fuzzbucket.
Oh, that would be really fun. I could totally see that working.
So who knows?
We might not have seen the last of Fuzzy. So
Fuzzy and his bucket.
Justin Haler wants to know, this is a two-parter. Are there any projects of yours you wish you could go back and do a director's cut on? Let's start with that first.
Not really. I don't really like the idea of going back over things that I've already done. Mm-hmm. And most of them pretty much are the director's cut. There's not been a whole lot of things that I would change other than tighten them up. But I don't really like looking back. You know, once something's under my belt, I'm ready to move on and be very forward-looking in that regard. I'm sure everything I've done could benefit from some more work. But, you know, I don't really want to. I like to leave what I've done as it stands and then just continue to move on and hopefully get better each time out.
What do you think about the directors who do go back and kind of tinker? I mean, we just had a new version of The Godfather 3 come out a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
It's great.
I've heard it's better. Yeah. Do you go back and watch those when they get released by some of the filmmakers you enjoy?
I will do that. I haven't seen that yet. And I haven't seen the Dr. Sleep director's cut either yet. But they're all valid. I can only speak for myself, you know. A huge proportion of the director cuts that I have seen have not been improvements. They've been a bit self-indulgent. You know, there is a reason to tighten things as you're getting close to your release date, mm-hmm. and make it move at its best clip. And sometimes there are things that you're so personally connected to that you want to put it back in, that, oh, I miss this scene that I wrote that had this going on. And if you don't need it, it's okay to lose it. Right. If it's something that doesn't impact the movie around it in a negative sense. If it adds to your movie, put it back in. If it detracts from your movie or makes it a longer experience rather than a better experience, then. But I'm only speaking for me. I think every director who gets an opportunity to go back and do a director's cut, if they feel that they really missed out on some things that they would rather have had in there, then by all means, let's see it.
I'll tell you, I really enjoyed Mike's director's cut for Dr. Sleep.
I hear great things about it.
Yeah, I liked it even more than the version I saw in the theater. I don't know if that's because when we talked to him on the podcast, I heard such great stories and I his passion was so infectious that when I watched it again, it was a more enriching experience, or it was just the director's cut. But either way, it's great. I would definitely check it out sooner than later. The second part of Justin's question is kind of along the same lines, but it's, are there any scenes that were cut from your scripts that you wish you had shot? Have you ever gotten to the edit room and cut a scene from a script and been like, gosh, I really am missing that piece of material?
Not really. You know, by the time we're shooting, well, there's an example, Valerie on the Stairs on Masters of Horror, my second season episode. We had to cut pages because the production was going over. We didn't have time. The day was going out. It's the only time in my life where I literally pulled pages out of the script and threw them aside. But it survived that, and it was just fine, and maybe even better for it. You know, we just have recorded an episode of the podcast with a famous screenwriter and director who talks about how the more he deletes of his dialogue, the better the movie is. And, you know, I can understand that point of view. Richard Matheson once said to me, I wish movies didn't have any dialogue. I'd much rather write a movie with no dialogue. So, but I have no regrets about scenes that were in a script that I never shot.
Well, on that note, Mick, I look forward to chatting with you again soon. We've got more questions down the pike.
And if you have questions for me and Joe, please send them to Joe Russo Tweets, to Postmortem PM on Instagram and Twitter, and to the Postmortem with Mick Garris Facebook page. So we will see you next time. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Mick.
If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would let the world know about it by reviewing and rating it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you have comments or questions for our Ask Mick Anything shows, send them to producer Joe at Joe Russo Tweets or to at Mick Garris PM on Instagram or Twitter or the Postmortem with Mick Garris Facebook page. That's at Mick Garris PM on both Twitter and Instagram. And if you'd like to see my vintage and recent video interviews, making of documentaries, and audiobooks of some of my short stories, go to my website, mickgarrisinterviews.com.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.